You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of No Place Like Home by Kayode Gusby. One of his creations does just that. He conceived of the Lagoon, a modular sofa that strikes a balance between fluidity and structure with its deep, comfortable seats, as a functional piece of art that can be produced in various textures and colors. The idea is to have a sofa which is very nice to look at from the back, because sometimes they are a little bit boring, Juan said, something which really has a silhouette, like in fashion. For Mohadeed, his background served as inspiration. I don't pretend to be European. I'm a designer. I'm Argentinian. I am from Latin America. I have a different vision. I have a different school of design, he said. The design of a wool rug, for instance, riffs on the Chicana. The symbol, known as the Andean cross, and representing the connection between the physical and spiritual worlds, is dispersed in a gradient that brings to mind Vuitton's famous Damier checkerboard pattern. I'm totally passionate about craft. This is a mix between the heritage of Louis Vuitton and my story, Mohadeed added. Highlights from the home collections are permanently on view at the Via Montenapoleone store in Milan, the brand's first to dedicate an entire floor to design. There, shoppers may enjoy the opportunity to closely examine the pieces, among them a totem turntable and sound system, and a signature hanging cocoon, because at Vuitton, a chair is never just a chair. A modern Prometheus, from ushering in Citizens United to granting vast immunity powers, John Roberts paved the way for Donald Trump's destructive second term, by Christian Farias, with an illustration by Andre Carrillo, which shows Trump strapped to a gurney as if he were in Frankenstein's lab, with Elon Musk serving as assistant. Forgotten in the arc of John Roberts' nearly two decades as Chief Justice of the United States is his role behind the scenes to herald the result in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. No, he didn't write the ruling that ushered in our current era of corporations and billionaires buying the presidency of the United States and other offices. But he can be credited with moving the chess pieces that made that sweeping landmark, authored by Justice Anthony Kennedy, possible. One version of the story finds Roberts so spooked by an unpublished dissenting opinion by outgoing Justice David Souter that the chief moved heaven and earth so that that document would never see the light of day. In it, Souter, a Republican and a big defender of campaign finance laws, called out Roberts for twisting the Supreme Court's own internal rules to arrive at a far-reaching outcome in an otherwise small bore dispute. In this case, a decree that the First Amendment places no limits on so-called independent corporate and union expenditures in our elections. That's not the legal question the Supreme Court had been asked to decide. And so other versions of this palace intrigue find Souter pleading with Roberts and the rest of the court to not overrule prior precedents curbing the influence of money in politics, and to rehear the case so that those precedents could get a second look and a fresh round of briefing and argument. Souter got his parting gift. On the final day before the Supreme Court broke for its summer break in June 2009, Roberts announced that the case would be re-argued at a later hearing. Immediately thereafter, as his last order of business that day, the chief also announced, with sadness, that this is the last session in which our friend and colleague Justice David Souter will be on the bench with us. Problem solved. By the next January, Citizens United would become the law of the land. This is but one data point for how Roberts, more than any other politician in the United States, has set the stage for Donald Trump's disruptive second presidency, one far more destructive than the first, and yet distinct in kind from any other in modern history, in that the presidency truly feels unbound. And in advancing an extreme vision of presidential authority, he's no longer ruling over Washington and the nation as a lone head of state. Instead, the executive power, which Article II of the Constitution vests in one president of the United States, has been freely shared with billionaire and mega-millionaire ruling partners, Elon Musk chief among them. Trump's cabinet, the wealthiest in history, at least holds legitimacy in that its members, like Linda McMahon and Howard Lutnick, were approved by the Senate, as the founding document instructs. Not so Musk. The Tesla and SpaceX chief, who donated $250 million to Trump's reelection effort and over time has received tens of billions in government contracts from a multitude of agencies, has operated in a constitutional vacuum, largely unconstrained by law or rules of ethics. As the leader of the inaptly named Department of Government Efficiency, which is neither a congressionally approved department nor efficient by established metrics, Musk was allowed to wield a breathtaking level of authority over the executive departments and other agencies he's beholden to, above and beyond that of the cabinet itself. Much of this unchecked lawlessness is water under the bridge by now, as judges, save some exceptions, have been too slow to stop the bleeding or police abuses, whether that be funding cuts Congress never approved or shocks to the federal workforce. Sensing early on how this unholy alliance of money and power flew in the face of rules, Roberts and his court have erected for officers of the United States, as spelled out in the constitutional text, a group of Democratic attorneys general cried foul in federal court. Although our constitutional system was designed to prevent the abuses of an 18th century monarch, the instruments of unchecked power are no less dangerous in the hands of a 21st century tech baron. One can only wonder what Roberts thinks of a duly elected chief executive and an unelected de facto prime minister leading the charge on mass firings across federal agencies, dismantling decades-old departments, and impounding appropriations that by definition are already the law. Roberts' own branch of government is not exempt from DOJ's intrusions. Judges, law clerks, and court employees have all been put on high alert over the Trump administration's documented encroachment even on day-to-day court operations. These breaches of the separation of powers, both real and imagined, and the anti-constitutional monster spreading its tentacles across Washington would have horrified the founders. But that's yet another consequence of unlimited wealth corrupting our politics. Democracy gives way to an oligarchy. That, in turn, may buy you a quasi-monarchy with few guardrails. Roberts and the other justices responsible for Citizens United may well believe that independent expenditures do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption, as they insisted at the time. The Trump-Musk reign of chaos has put that idea, fanciful then and now, to rest. The corrupt bargain should haunt Roberts in other ways. During the presidential transition, as if anticipating the legal resistance to the incoming Trump administration, the chief saw the future when he dedicated his year-end report on the federal judiciary to the threats to their independence judges face day to day. The report, which doesn't mention Trump by name, is nonetheless replete with not-so-veiled allusions to what the president and his supporters have visited upon judges since he took office, including threats of violence, intimidation, and disinformation about what individual court rulings mean or require. These dangerous suggestions, however sporadic, he wrote, must be soundly rejected. Defiance, which has been a theme of the past 6 months, hasn't abated. And that's because one element Roberts didn't foresee was that Trump wouldn't be the only one with pitchforks out against judges. Musk, other administration officials, and far-right figures who have grown in influence on X and in the president's circle have also joined this high-tech lynching, to borrow from Clarence Thomas. When an incensed Stephen Miller grossly misrepresented a Supreme Court ruling that urged the Trump administration to facilitate the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland man who had been unlawfully sent back to a prison in his native El Salvador, that only set the stage for more defiance by the White House. In that case, as in other politically charged cases, Trump has been on the losing side in the courts. And the more he loses, the fiercer his and his supporters' attacks on judges get. Indeed, a Reuters investigation in May found that John J. McConnell Jr. and James Boasberg, chief judges of their respective federal districts in Rhode Island and the District of Columbia, are top of the list among federal judges whose families have faced threats of violence or harassment after they ruled against the new Trump administration. Roberts has tried to turn down the heat to little effect. For more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. Roberts wrote in a statement in March as Boasberg phobia reached a fever pitch. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose. The attacks didn't relent. At a portrait unveiling in May for John D. Bates, a George W. Bush appointee, and yet another veteran judge MAGA has viciously targeted for ruling against Trump, Roberts could be seen sitting next to Boasberg and other members of the judiciary in Washington, lending his presence and offering pleasantries in a room full of judges at a moment many of them feel under siege. As it happens, many of these same judges collectively presided over more than 1,000 prosecutions related to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Then, as now, they've had to contend with an emboldened right-wing fever swamp led by the President of the United States that cast the rioters as political prisoners. The nation has Roberts to thank in part for this attempt to rewrite the history of the assault on our democracy. The chief led the way not only in granting Trump broad immunity over his actions and inactions on that day, he also shielded him from the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment by blocking a bid by Colorado voters to bar him from the ballot. Had Roberts not maneuvered to defang that centerpiece of the post-Civil War amendments in this latter case, Trump might have been ousted from public life for good. In the face of all this aiding and abetting, Roberts' gestures and public comments in defense of judges come across as woefully insufficient. Worse, they mask his hand in paving the way for Trump's worst excesses in just about every area of law and policy that matters to his administration. Fresh on the public's mind is the Supreme Court's indefensible immunity decision, which effectively shut down a criminal trial accusing Trump of masterminding his disruption of the transfer of power. Roberts' florid language in that ruling makes it plain that he believes the president deserves special treatment as the head of one branch of government, beyond the reach of the casual cruelty that everyone else faces in the criminal system. Yet the longer-term import of Trump versus United States, as longtime scholars of executive power have observed, may be how the Trump administration is embracing it today. In Trump's hands, the ruling isn't just a shield from prosecution. It's a weapon to decimate the federal workforce, to dismantle agencies Republicans and business interests have long disliked, and to fire independent watchdogs and regulators Congress has seen fit to protect from White House interference. Indeed, the idea that Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president authority over every corner of the executive branch has long been a Roberts hobby horse, and the Trump administration is riding it everywhere it goes. When Trump unlawfully fired National Labor Relations Board member Gwen Wilcox, the first time in the history of the Labor Board that had happened, the Justice Department relied on the immunity decision and others by Roberts to justify the dismissal. The president's firing authority is untouchable by Congress, D. John Sauer, the Solicitor General, told the Supreme Court in a legal brief. And so the chief went right along, and acting on his own, quickly allowed Wilcox's firing to proceed. More than a month later, without bothering to hear oral arguments, his majority ignored nearly a century of precedent and gave Trump complete control over the NLRB's leadership. Today's order, Justice Elena Kagan wrote in dissent, favors the president over our precedent. Carried to its logical end, Roberts' jurisprudence bolstering an all-powerful and energetic president to do as he pleases spares no one. Not the beloved Librarian of Congress, fired. Not the transformative Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, fighting for its life. And certainly not the unlawfully renditioned migrants disappeared to a notorious El Salvador prison, still disappeared. In all these instances, the Trump administration can point to a constitutional ruling by Roberts for justification. Even the Trump-led purge of a government that is diverse, equitable, and inclusive, or part of its all-out war against Harvard University, can be traced back to Roberts' blinkered thinking on race. Eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. Trump's Washington is Roberts' Washington, and the greatest feat of the Supreme Court that bears their names may yet be the wholesale destruction of government as we know it. In one executive order that garnered little attention, Trump directed his agencies on a review and repeal rampage to get rid of rules of governance that have long been on the books. The source for this directive? 10 cherry-picked decisions, all but one of them issued by Roberts, majority or supermajority. Covering everything from affirmative action policies to environmental law to religion and public life that the administration thinks should carry the day. It's too early to tell where this slash-and-burn campaign will end up, but if nearly 20 years of Roberts have taught us anything, it is that once he rules, the nation is left to figure out how to fix what he has broken, if it can be fixed at all. And now for the cover story, Braveheart, by Karen Valby, with photos by Solve Sonjbo, styled by Beat Bolliger. Pedro Pascal's emotional depth on screen and his exuberance everywhere else have skyrocketed him to the top of the A-list and made him a sex symbol in middle age, a funny, sad, wildly honest talk with a star unlike any other. Pedro Pascal photographed at Spring Studios in London on May 8th. To his friends and family, he is Pepelo, Pipi, Peders, and Peds. Years ago, on a movie set, someone started calling him Pepsi, which he loved. Fans on the internet famously refer to him as Daddy or Zaddy, meaning he's a handsome, stylish older man they can imagine dominating them in a way they would not object to. In a 2022 video for Vanity Fair, part of the magazine's lie detector series, he laughed off the nickname. "Daddy is a state of mind," he said. "I'm your daddy." He was being playful, but his eye contact with the camera was so transfixing that some observers only heard the second sentence of that statement. Bella Ramsey, his young co-star on The Last of Us, the show that truly catapulted him to stardom, disliked the daddy label the minute it was affixed to their friend. "I felt worried for him. I want to protect him from that whole joke of becoming the internet's daddy. I was like, I don't want everyone to refer to you as that and see you as that. You're so much more." Ramsey calls him Pedge. "For simplicity's sake, I am going to call him Pedro Pascal." Over lunch in London, Pascal is a grand raconteur who tells stories with his hands and uses funny voices and loves to swear and drink cocktails and murder a cheese plate. And he doesn't take himself too seriously. At the same time, he'll press right up against sad and raw and confusing parts of being alive. His insides are on his outsides. He cries easily. He laughs loudly. Pascal tells me about his give-up years when he was a struggling actor in New York, decimated by the sudden death of his beloved mother, Veronica. At night, he'd return from whatever restaurant or bar job he hadn't yet been fired from to the apartment in Brooklyn he couldn't afford. However depressing his life, his pit bull mix rescue Greta would meet him excitedly at the door. Greta's silhouette was intimidating enough that Pascal could walk her at 3 a.m. to deposit his crumpled wad of tips into a Chase ATM without fear. "She saved my life, that dog, because she gave me someone to go home to," Pascal says, searching through the Greta album on his phone to show me pictures. "In my 30s, I was supposed to have a career," he says. "Past 29 without a career meant that it was over, definitely." Feeling hopeless, Pascal started researching other professions. But whenever he came close to bailing on his dream, friends and family would step in. When Pedro would say, "I'm going to nursing school," or "I'm going to be a theater teacher," it was just like, "No, no, 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 you're too good," says his older sister, Javiera Balmaceda, now a producer at Amazon Studios. "He's wanted to be an actor since he was 4 years old. The one thing we'd never allow Pedro to do was give up." So Balmaceda would lend him $40 to make it through the weekend when he stopped by her office. Friends bought him groceries and took him to dinner. Neighbors helped take care of Greta. His close friend Sarah Paulson gave him her per diem money from acting gigs and let him use her sister's car. "Basically, everybody took care of me. Well into my 30s, he says. I had angels around me the whole time. Today is Pascal's first day off in ages. Last week, he was in Tokyo at the semi-annual Star Wars celebration, promoting next summer's release of Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu. He recently completed the Fantastic Four First Steps, and in the morning goes into production on the new Avengers Doomsday. Besides the Fantastic Four reboot, he's in two other summer movies, showing off interesting new angles, playing the ultimate bachelor and Celine Song's romance materialist, and a small-town mayor in Ari Aster's American Nightmare, Eddington. Meanwhile, on the day we meet, the internet is still soggy with the grief of The Last of Us fans processing the fate of Pascal's character, Joel, a good broken man with the saddest eyes in the world. The Fantastic Four's Vanessa Kirby, who plays Sue Storm to Pascal's stretchy genius Reed Richards, tells me that her friend's allure is his immense vulnerability. He doesn't have much armor, so he shows himself to you straight away, and you trust that person because he's revealing himself to you in this very brave way. Spike Jonze, who directed Pascal in an exuberant Apple ad that showcases the actor's joyful dance skills, has a unified field theory about why so many people are connecting with the 50-year-old actor who struggled to get hired for decades. I think that he's what we want in masculinity. It's not just about how rugged and alive Pascal is on screen. It's also his cheeky fun with fashion, chic black shorts and lipstick red Valentino to the Met Gala in 2023, Saint Laurent thigh-high boots to The Last of Us Season 2 premiere. It's how he bopped to Devo at the SNL 50 concert. It's how he publicly celebrated his younger sister, Lux Pascal, when she came out as transgender in 2021 and remains a passionate advocate of the community. Just how smitten is the world with this actor? While hosting the Critics' Choice Awards, Chelsea Handler cited 2023 as the year everyone became horny for Pedro Pascal. A New Yorker cartoon featured a therapist reassuring his client, "It's not strange at all. Lately, a lot of people are reporting that their faith in humanity is riding entirely on whether or not Pedro Pascal is as nice as he seems." "Well then," Ramsey tells me, "I'm relieved for humanity." When I first meet Pascal, it's in the lobby of his swanky hotel. I go in for a handshake, and he wraps me in a hug instead. On our way outside, we pass a bar, and he offers to make me a cocktail, then whisk me out the front door into a waiting black BMW. "Baby, I'm taking you on a date," he says. Pascal is happiest and most comfortable when the people around him are happy and comfortable. And because he is naturally so curious and warm, there's a sense of immediate safety with him. You're grateful to be in his light. As we're getting in the car, Pascal mentions his mother. He was 24 when she died by suicide. "My own mother died by suicide when I was 18, a fact I wasn't sure would be comfortable or appropriate to share." But then Pascal mentions that his mother got her PhD at San Antonio's Trinity University, where I was a college freshman when my mother died. The coincidence is so uncanny that I find myself spilling. Pascal immediately takes my hand. "Whether we like it or not, we're bonded," he says. We sit down at a Palestinian restaurant in Notting Hill. Pascal says he picked the restaurant because the last time he was here, he admired the booth in the afternoon light and thought it would be fun for us to share small plates of food. But he's posted more than once on Instagram about what's unfolding in Gaza, so I suspect he's also making a statement of support by doing an interview here. He removes his leather jacket and his green sweatshirt, stripping down to a simple white T-shirt, and lays his thick frame glasses on the table. Pascal turned 50 in April, a milestone he approached with irritation and dread. He cites the movie Another Woman, which made an enormous impression on him when he saw it as a porous 13-year-old. In it, Jenna Rollins delivers a bleak report on the emotional wind tunnel of finding herself in her 50s. "Stepping into my 40s felt adult and empowered," Pascal says. 50 felt more vulnerable, much more vulnerable. Even when he's on top of the world? More so, more so. What a silly thing for a 50-year-old man to have all this attention. This is such shadow voice shit, you know what I mean? So here we are, two motherless 50-year-olds drinking tequila at lunch. "Dare I say, to 50, I say, raising my drink. Pascal's face is so open and so game. He leans over the table and gives my glass a merry clink. "Abso-effing-lutely," he says, and off we go. He was 9 months old when his parents fled Chile to escape General Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship and eventually settled in San Antonio. Pascal's mother was a 22-year-old political refugee with two children studying child psychology. "So, yeah, I became kind of a guinea pig," says Pascal. On days when she didn't have a babysitter, she'd drop him off at the movie theater. He remembers being 7 and in heaven, able to squeeze in 2.5 showings of Poltergeist before his mom returned for him. At home, he'd reenact scenes of being sucked into the closet or slide across the kitchen floor. Balmaceda tells me, when our parents got cable, the HBO song would come on and Pedro would run around the house yelling, "A movie is coming! A movie is coming!" Pascal's preferred home base in life is the fourth row of a movie theater. He remembers a family film night dedicated to Steven Spielberg's The Color Purple. He sat at a distance from his family, as usual, preferring to be close to the screen. But then he started crying so loudly when Whoopi Goldberg's Celie was being separated from her sister that his mother had to collect him and help him catch his breath outside. For the rest of fifth grade, he carried a copy of Alice Walker's novel around like it was the Bible. If his parents recognized the artistic sensitivities of their son, it didn't affect their expectations. Being immigrant parents, they were always kind of like, yeah, whatever, as long as you go to a good college, says Balmaceda with a laugh. She describes their father, a fertility doctor, as very demanding. You had to have great grades, great manners, great taste, always. In middle school, Pascal's family relocated to a wealthy and conservative Orange County, California enclave where all the palm trees are the same height. He still can't stomach going back to visit. Middle school was a horror. He was bullied for being a weird, sensitive kid, for being an attention-hungry kid, for being in love with the movies and theater and art. He remembers the movie Gorillas in the Mist being a lifeline. He saw it again and again in the theater, patched back together by Sigourney Weaver's performance and Maurice Jarre's dreamlike score. Pascal honestly doesn't know if he would have survived the bullying and abuse if his mother hadn't pulled him out of his local school system and found him a school for the arts. He got his license and the keys to Veronica's Volvo. He and his new best friend, Grace, would drive into L.A. and dance their faces off at raves. Drugs were everywhere. Pascal remembers being 16 and taking acid and calling his mother to check in and let her know he was going to spend the night out. And she sighs and goes, "Oh, and that was not normal." And I was like, "Well, why?" And she said, "Oh, no, I was just hoping that we would all go to a movie. I was just so drawn to that kind of maternal attention, so I said, 'I'm coming.'" He rushed home and sat mute and paralyzed, tripping in the back seat as they drove to see John Sayles' City of Hope. Pascal moved to New York City to study acting at NYU, where he immediately fell into a crowd of former LaGuardia High School performing arts students that included Paulson. "No one was more fun," she tells me, "but he was also sad. There's a well of pain that lives right behind his eyes that he's never tried to hide from, and I think it's what makes him so translucent as an actor. It was just magnetic for me as a young person, and still is today. I was having a really hard time when I was 18, 19, 20, Pascal tells me. "I was struggling really badly with insomnia. I was reading James Baldwin and watching movies like Once Were Warriors and Muriel's Wedding. I just was like an open wound to the reality of life." He pauses to smack the table with his hand, groaning and laughing at himself. "It sounds so effing pretentious, but I felt at this crossroads of coming into an understanding of what an unjust world we live in. This world and its lack of equanimity is just too painful to bear. How do you live in it?" When we first ordered, Pascal told our server he was trying to stay off bread because, well, because he's an actor. It's still hard to accept that he can't order Shake Shack every night at 10 p.m. for dinner. The server lays a plate stacked with warm pita on the table. "Hey, you put the bread right in front of me," he teases. He takes a big forkful of Nabolsi cheese. He won't give up cheese. At night, he dreams about Gorgonzola. Pascal asked me about where I live, what my 16-year-old loved about the movie Sinners, which he adored, what I'm reading, the circumstances of my mother's death. Pascal was 24 and living in Los Angeles when he got the phone call about his own mom. He took the first flight to Santiago. His parents had returned in 1995 with his younger brother, Nicolas, and Lux. After the services for his mother, Pascal returned a hallowed man to pilot season, stupefied that he'd once considered landing a role in a new Dark Angel series of any consequence. "You think not getting a job can break me? You can't break me. I'm already broken." 6 months after his mother's death, Pascal agreed to foster a puppy to help out a friend. The first night in his apartment, the dog jumped into bed with him. Through the thin walls, Pascal could hear his neighbors watching the indie movie High Art. He listened to the scene of Ally Sheedy's character panicking over her overdosing girlfriend, played by Patricia Clarkson, and felt the warmth of this creature next to him. He knew he was going to keep this puppy and name her after a fictional German heroin addict. His grief had no place in Los Angeles, with its isolating highways and traffic and sprawl, so he went home to New York City, where he'd made some headway as an actor after college, only to find that his early luck had run out. He lived in a seventh-floor apartment of an East Village walk-up. Every night, he'd have a cigarette on his fire escape and watch the moon rise between the Twin Towers. After 9/11, he moved to Red Hook with Greta. Of his nursing school plan B, he now insists he would have made a terrible nurse. "I'd be a selective nurse like I was as a waiter. I'd fall in love with some patients and hate others. And that poor patient that I hated." The Labyrinth Theater Company, where he started to write and direct, became an artistic lifeline. He broke into regional theater, shipping off to Oregon or Washington, D.C. or Boston or Cape Cod or Lowell, Massachusetts. In 2013, Paulson, chief among the angels looking out for him, passed his audition tape for Game of Thrones along to her best friend, Amanda Peet, whose husband, David Benioff, co-ran the show, and a star was born. Pascal's blisteringly charismatic turn as Oberyn Martell led him to 3 seasons on the DEA drama Narcos, which led him to The Last of Us and beyond. Pascal's beloved dog was at his side right up until that big break in Game of Thrones when she died of old age. "I think about how poor I was when I had Greta," Pascal says. "I think about when I had double shifts and I couldn't find anybody to let her out, and we were living in the shithole apartment in Red Hook. And I think about the bougie life she would be leading with me now, as opposed to then, and I grieve. I really do." He chokes back a sob, then laughs at himself for being once more overcome. "You've been making me cry since we effing started talking," he tells me, shaking his fist in mock anger. "Don't let me order a third drink." Pascal wants to make sure I get dessert and suggests we walk around the block looking for something sweet. But he's also due at Robert Downey Jr.'s house, which is a 45-minute drive away, for an Avengers cast homework day. And then he has evening theater plans, so he's nervous about the time and trying not to show it. He is a people pleaser. He's working on it, he tells me. I tell him I can go without dessert and suggest that he let me tag along on the ride to Downey's house so we can finish our conversation. His relief is enormous. As we wait for the check, we talk about some of the realities of fame. For instance, the Internet's real-time dissection of his coffee order. his vacation reading, and since, as Handler said, people of every kind are horny for him, why he doesn't talk about his own personal life in the press. I always feel perplexed when I'm identified in whatever form of media as a highly private person, because that's the opposite of me, he says. I'm very unprivate in my private life. I just know that personal relationships are such a complex thing to navigate, even without having this enormous lens on them. As for having kids, Pascal tells me that he hasn't longed to do it, except in a very particular way. I've had dreams of taking my kids to the movies the way my parents took me. So I guess I want a shortcut to an interesting human being who is my child, who will go see something that I want to see. On Instagram, Pascal is forthright about his progressive values, posting about his horror over political headlines, as well as sending love to his siblings and championing his and others' projects. The week before our meeting, the UK Supreme Court has released a landmark anti-trans ruling limiting the legal definition of a woman to the basis of biological sex. J.K. Rowling, who has largely funded the UK's war on the trans community, celebrated the ruling in a cruelly glib Instagram post. Pascal, ferociously protective of his baby sister, Lux, called out Rowling's rotten glee on Instagram as a heinous loser behavior. Some tried to frame it as a man trying to bully a woman into silence, but it is heinous loser behavior, Balmaceda says. And he said that as the older brother to someone saying that our little sister doesn't exist. As it grew into a larger story, Pascal felt briefly like that kid that got sent to the principal's office a lot for behavioral issues in public schools in Texas, feeling scared and thinking, what did I do? But something else worried him more. The one thing that I would say I agonized over a little bit was just, am I helping? Am I effing helping? It's a situation that deserves the utmost elegance so that something can actually happen and people will actually be protected. Listen, I want to protect the people I love, but it goes beyond that. Bullies make me effing sick. In an epic bad faith argument, some Rowling defenders tried to turn a viral clip of Pascal taking Kirby's hand at last year's Fantastic Four panel at Comic-Con into evidence that he's presumptuous with women. What happened is we were both incredibly nervous going out in front of thousands of people who love this comic, says Kirby. He wanted me to know that we were in this together, and I found it a lovely gesture and was very glad to squeeze his hand back. In the movie, the superpower couple is married with a baby en route. Pascal hasn't seen the finished movie yet, but says, I'm getting an inkling of excitement because it seems to reflect what our common goal was and what we want to share, which is all of our effing hearts on a platter within this genre. You just never know if people are going to be disgusted by your heart or not. He admits that entering the Marvel Universe has not been without jitters. I'm more aware of disgruntlement around my casting than anything I've ever done. He's too old, he's not right, he needs to shave. Pascal takes succor from his new Avenger friend, Downey. He's just so immediately generous and inviting that you feel like you can be afraid. You can be hungry, you can be ambivalent. And Downey speaks for many of us when he tells me, Pascal's slow trajectory to becoming a household name who is on a wildly hot streak kind of reaffirms my faith in our industry. On our way out of the restaurant, I ask Pascal what today's Avengers homework day will entail. Very good question, he says coyly. Which of the Avengers will be there? Good question. And now you're an Avenger? I don't know, Pascal says, laughing. Let's go back to talking about death and suicide again and not the Avengers. In the car, Pascal gasps and points out the window. Look at that cemetery. Isn't it gorgeous, he says. He doesn't want to be buried. Just throw him in the ocean. Fish food, he says. And yet, I find sometimes cemeteries are so beautiful. So yes, now we're back to talking about death. On February 4th, 2023, the anniversary of his mother's passing, Pascal hosted Saturday Night Live for the first time. It was a triumph. In his monologue, he choked up while honoring his parents for their courage fleeing Chile when he was a baby. Musical guest Coldplay's Chris Martin dedicated Fix You to Pascal and Veronica. Pascal's childhood hero Steven Spielberg watched the show from the wings and, a month later at the Oscars, would congratulate him on a stellar job. Paulson, who'd flown in that morning to appear as the mother to Pascal's daddy in a sketch, stayed with him at the after-party until the sun came up. "It was just a night we didn't want to end," she says. "If there had been a camera on me when it was happening, and there'd been a slow push in, it would have shown me watching his life begin, because he was so, so present and having this wild time. And he had no idea that it was going so well. And with the timing of his mother and this moment in his career, it was like a rebirth. Pascal cries talking to me about it. I just felt like my mother was there. And I don't know what else to say. It was a complete transformation of an anniversary." He also reclaimed his birthday this year. 2 months after his mother died, Pascal tried celebrating his 25th birthday, but the whole night was horrible and sideways and wrong. Without making a conscious decision, he stopped acknowledging his birthday to any real extent. Friends over the years would try to cajole him into a night on the town, but the most he'd agree to was being taken out for a martini or getting high and going to see How to Train Your Dragon. By the time he was 49, he felt like his body was starting to turn on him. He'd injured his back on the set of Gladiator II. Then he fell down some stairs at his dad's house in Chile and dislocated his shoulder. When Handler called out his universal sex appeal at the Critics' Choice Awards, he remembers with a wince, "I was in a sling, I was overweight, and when the camera cut to me, I didn't think anything could be further from the truth." When Pascal started filming Materialist last spring, in which he woos Dakota Johnson's matchmaker character, he was out of the sling but still couldn't do a push-up or lift weights. "It was the oldest I'd ever felt in my life," he says. "It was the weakest I'd ever felt. It was such a scary, fraudulent thing to feel like I could play somebody who was the catch of Manhattan." He seems genuinely relieved when I tell him how dashing he is in the movie and what a natural romantic lead. "You think I'm hot in it? Thank God. That was his first shot at a romance, and he's curious about doing it again." Pascal has only played a true lead once, in a 2003 stage production of Kenneth Lonergan's Lobby Hero for a small theater in Cape Cod. What would it be like, he wonders, to carry a film like one of his favorite actors, Daniel Kaluuya, did in Get Out? But again, stepping into it at my age, it's hard for me to, Pascal says, then breaks off. "I ask myself, is that realistic?" He cringes. "I can't believe how ageist my interview is going to be, but it's what I'm living." Pascal needed to make peace with crossing this bullshit milestone of 50, so he decided to lean in headlong, planning a multi-day celebration he compares to a wedding. On April 2nd, he hosted an intimate dinner for family and friends at a London restaurant whose martini he knew to be a winner. All three of his siblings were there, along with his father. Luck surprised him with a slideshow of pictures of Pascal and his friends and family over the years, even Greta, that finished to the song Corazón de Melón. Three separate times he tries to explain how moved he was by his sister's gift without crying. "I'm not like this every day, I swear to God," he says, laughing. "But when you feel seen like I did that night, you feel touched by magic." A couple nights later, the celebration continued with a banger of a party at Stone Nest, the former Limelight Club in London. Pascal hired Honey Dijon, a trans woman and divine Grammy-winning DJ and fashion icon. He wore a black nylon 4S Designs overcoat over a Protect the Dolls t-shirt, and his friends spun him around the dance floor on their shoulders. His family was there. his high school bestie Grace, Paulson and the LaGuardia gang from New York, his best friends from college who are now doctors, lawyers, and professors, the Fantastic Four cast, and other actor friends. Paulson remembers looking around the adoring eclectic crowd and thinking, "We were once teenage nutballs running around New York. And now Tom Cruise is dancing at your party. What has happened to your life?" In the car to Downey's house, Pascal points at the word faith, which someone has spray-painted on a wall. He scrunches up his face in mock disgust. He's agnostic, practically an atheist, and yet I still feel like I'm being mothered sometimes. I feel her witness all around me. I don't feel like any of this right now would be happening if it weren't for her. There was something magical about Maria Veronica Pascal Urreta. Her firstborn son misses everything about her. Her beauty, her smell, how funny she was, and how funny she found farts. She couldn't get past a fart of any kind without it absolutely destabilizing her into hysterics, says Pascal. She thought they were the most brilliant, hilarious, wonderful thing in the world. She was also very deep-feeling, very complex, very, very out of reach in a way, he adds. Pascal's mother tried as best she could to know her son. She read To Kill a Mockingbird after seeing the profound effect it had on Pascal in grade school. She pored over For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Was Enough, which consumed Pascal after his high school English teacher read the Lady in Red monologue. She let her 17-year-old son skip school to see a pre-Broadway production of Angels in America. When Pascal came home awestruck, emotionally reorganized by what he'd seen, she bought herself a ticket so she could experience some of what her son felt. Pascal has a tattoo of his mother's signature on the inside of his right wrist. "I have a tattoo in honor of my mother on the inside of my left." As a goodbye outside of Downey's house, we touch our griefs against each other for a moment, which is maybe what the movies or literature or theater allows us to do. On New Year's Eve, Pascal wrote down his wish for 2025, heal, for real. When I next speak with Pascal, he's flush from an energizing weekend in Reykjavik, Iceland, where he met with the Canadian poet Anne Carson after being put in touch by the artistic director at the Shed Theater in New York. Over Zoom, he says that they're in early talks to collaborate on a piece she's writing that he'd perform. The stage kept his dreams of being an artist alive for so long. He wants to go home to it. He's not sure about his next film project. See, it's over. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.